This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville, our weekly mix of special programs and homemade radio features. This week we have three interviews we hope will educate, enlighten, and inspire. As we continue to explore the issue of suicide, we'll hear the story of the importance of listening.
You deal with it and don't talk about it, and it doesn't work like that. I even had that mindset too. It cost my son his life.
We'll also get an update on Huntsville's effort to boost its local music scene with the release of a new local music survey. You can find a link to that survey at WLRH.org.
What we really started to discover is there's a reason folks aren't aware of the diversity in the scene. It's because a lot of them, even within the music industry, sort of fall into silos. And there aren't a lot of places where you can see these kind of cultures overlapping.
And you'll hear the second part of an interview series examining how the Tennessee Valley's water resources are managed. The Public Radio Hour is next. We hope you stay tuned. This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville, our weekly mix of special programs and homemade radio features. I'm Brett Tannehill. This week, we'll talk with Huntsville City Planner Dennis Madsen about the newly released Local Music Survey, which is part of an effort to strengthen our buzzworthy local music scene. Community Newsroom producer Kathy Jones takes our public microphone to talk with the Tennessee Valley Authority about how it manages water in the Tennessee River. But first, between 1999 and 2016, the suicide rate in America grew in every state but one, Nevada, where the rate dropped by just 1%. In Alabama during that span, the suicide rate increased by nearly 22%. Jenny Kennedy is exploring this issue in a series of interviews. She recently talked with Wendy Galloway, who lost her son to suicide.
Well, I love to talk about my son, Aaron Alexander. He was 19 years old. He had just started his military career in the Army National Guard, and he was smart and funny, and he loved his family and his country. He loved the military history. He also, over the years, had gone back and forth with depression. There was never an official diagnosis of that, but there were extreme moods. And after we had moved to Alabama from Colorado, he was actually doing really well. And I mean, he was over the moon to be a part of the military. And was very excited. He graduated from Fort Benning Basic Training in March of 2016. And when he got home, you know, he was great. Everything was great. And he really started struggling with what to do as far as going active, going to school. I think there were some things that were happening with friends. There was some stuff that happened with his father. And on July 10th, 2016, he took his life. He died by suicide. And it's been hard ever since.
But you're very brave to keep speaking about it.
I want to talk about my son. I'm not ashamed of him. You know, his life is what mattered. And I'm very proud of him. And I want people to know his story and to know who he was. And I do talk about how he died and about suicide because I want people to talk about it. And one of the things I see and that, you know, even my son had done, there were times that he would say that he wanted to kill himself. And it had gotten to the point where I didn't really take it serious because it would be in one of his extreme moods that he was upset. You know, it's a very off-the-cuff comment. And the more I've thought about it, it's like we really do need to think about what we're saying and how we say it and be aware of our conversations. And Aaron also would say, he goes, he would also say, Mom, I would never do it, though, because of you and my family.
And why would you not believe him?
Right. So, you know, there were a lot of factors. And so it wasn't the typical stereotypes that you hear in the suicide list of, you know, this is kind of the basics of what happened. So every situation is different. But, you know, it's just so important that we talk about it and and reach out to people. And, you know, that's one of the things that's happened. I've had a couple people come to me and say, you know, they're saying this, and I'm like, you have to take it serious. Mm-hmm. I didn't. And the result is my son is gone. So we have to take it serious on the side of the person that's hearing it. But then it also really needs to start being conveyed to the kids that are saying it, that I don't know how to describe it in terms of, you know, making sure that they understand how serious it is mm-hmm. when they say that. And because if you keep saying it and keep saying it, people don't, they stop listening.
Right,
and
it's
they
a crime
don't
wolf.
Take, right. Mm-hmm. And then something really happens and it's too late. So.
And there's not a formula, there's not a path that we all can follow to go, oh, I should have done this, and I'll do this, this, and this, and everything will be fine. We're sort of in the dark,
right.
always.
Well, and, you know, for a long time, some of the things I did do, and then there were things that I was trying to back off of because he was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he
right.
was 19, he was a soldier, he could get called overseas, mm-hmm. and you're going around trying to do the best that you can. And then, of course, you know, if something like this happens, you look back and there's all these scenarios of what you could have done mm-hmm. or should have done. And, I mean, I do bear responsibility and, you know, I always will. And it's not a guilt thing or feeling sorry for myself. You know, I had a responsibility to my son and it was a thing of I started thinking I just have to, you know, let him find his way.
Well, any parent would do that, of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So in the years following, what has helped you?
The first year I was pretty much in a daze and it was very difficult, but I finally found there is the group through the Crisis Services of North Alabama. Mm-hmm. It is a program that survivors of, you know, suicide, that families that have lost loved ones. We meet twice a month, and it's a group where Connie, of course, runs it, and she's the facilitator, and we're able to talk to other people that share our circumstances. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always variations, but we have a general understanding of what happened and, you know, what we're going through. And I've gotten involved with the AFSP. I participated in the Out of the Darkness Walk, mm-hmm. and I will be participating in it again this year in October. There is a movie called Suicide, The Ripple Effect.
Right, I read about
Kevin
that.
By Kevin Hines. Mm-hmm. He's a phenomenal person, and he created this documentary. And I did a showing of that back in April. So I've just started trying to do things to bring more awareness mm-hmm. to suicide, you know, more awareness that people need to talk to each other. I can't get people to talk to me about my son.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
I don't know, because I tell them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I flat out say, I want to talk about my son. Mm-hmm. I want to hear his name. People will never ask me again, how is Aaron doing? That's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so painful. So to have people tell me stories about Aaron, or to ask me to tell them a story about Aaron, or, you know, even just like with a movie or something, like he likes Star Wars, mm-hmm. to have somebody say, oh, Aaron would have loved mm-hmm. this. I'm the only one that does that, you know? And so it's really hard because I don't understand. And that's the part that makes me cry a lot, sorry. But I just don't understand why people won't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, well, I don't want to upset you. Well, I live in that every day. You know, what actually makes me feel good is to hear his name, to have somebody say something to me. You know, I was thinking about Aaron today. And my mom will send me texts once in a while saying stuff like that, but it's just really hard to get people to do that because there's just such a stigma, you know, with suicide and how he died. And, you know, that's not what matters about him, though.
Tell me an Aaron story.
He loved the military. He loved military history. He even loved the music. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'd play these songs and I'd be like, do I really have to listen to this, honey? But he volunteered at the Veterans Museum. Mm-hmm. He loved the Veterans Museum. He called it his church. And he probably would have volunteered there even more. But he'd go there on Saturdays. I'd take him over there. He had a mentor, Ray, who he just adored. And they got to work on tanks.
Wow.
So he thought that was pretty exciting. You know, but anything to do with the military, he...
Why do you think he was drawn to the military?
You know, I don't know what it was, really. Because, I mean, there's some in the family background, but it's not a real dominant, you know, that he grew up with having a lot of family members that, you know, were lifelong mm-hmm. military backgrounds. But I even have a video of him when he was probably about 6 years old, and he was sitting in his room playing with little army men.
Oh, yeah.
And they asked him about it, and he goes, I'm playing the best game ever, mm-hmm. Army. Uh-huh. So, you know, it's something that he ended up drawn to, and when he fixated on something, mm-hmm. he didn't let it go. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, he was proud of his country, and
he looked sharp in his uniform.
Yes, he did very much.
And he was happy with the military. You can't blame the military for what happened to him, can you?
No, he was afraid to say anything because, you know, there some of the times when he would say things, I would be like, well, if you really feel like this, we need to get help. Mm-hmm, we need mm-hmm. to go and talk to somebody. And, I mean, I distinctly remember him saying, you know, I don't want to mess up my military, Mom. And so, you know, and there is a stigma in the military with, you know, mental health and mm-hmm. getting help. And I know there are programs and different organizations that are working at changing that. Mm-hmm. But it is still something that, you know, you just don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And because even when he was in basic training, he said that, you know, if you got hurt, you just... You know, you suck it up.
Right.
And
my dad was a Marine, so
yeah,
I know.
He definitely, you know. But they even, because, you know, he had a card for the Battle Buddies, because in basic training, he loved his Battle Buddies. Mm. You know, he really bonded with them. I even have a letter from him that he said, Mom, I feel like I really belong. And, you know, because he had trouble through school mm-hmm. with bullying and things like that. But even though, you know, they're handing out these cards and saying, you know, reach out, it's like there's still this unwritten rule that we cannot get people over that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want. I want people over that hump. And
well, people,
you know,
are talking more about PTSD, so let's talk about it pre-PTSD. Let's talk about it now.
Well, and because when PTSD first started being talked about, it was definitely military related. It was combat mm-hmm. veterans. From what I see and what I hear now, it's definitely branched out mm-hmm. in that it's a much broader term mm-hmm. now. People need to get help before it's
We need to deal with pre-traumatic stress
right.
disorder rather than post.
Right, right. And, you know, I mean, when the veterans, when they're out in the field, they're, you know, we can't even imagine what they're experiencing, mm-hmm. especially in combat. So that's a whole nother thing. But there are people that do join the military that they have things that do need to be dealt with. And, we need to get it to where they're okay with asking for that help, mm-hmm. that they're not judged and that they're not put down and that they're not demoted or,
right.
you know, whatever they're afraid of happening to mm-hmm. them, that they do feel a sense of security. Because even if they're having, you know, an emotional problem or something, they sign up to serve our country, and we owe that to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, in general, too, it's not just the military.
Right.
Mental illness is another stigma, and mm-hmm. Just can't get people to understand that mental illness is real. It's not, you know, something that somebody's making up.
No, why would you?
I know. But it happens. Mm-hmm. I know I have NAMI's also another organization.
National Alliance for the Mentally Ill.
Yes. Mm-hmm. With Rebecca is her name, and she's fantastic as well. Her and I have met and talked about different things that to do to raise awareness for mm-hmm. suicide prevention, mm-hmm. and she's another really amazing mm-hmm. person, too. But we just, I don't know, it's always, you know, you deal with it and don't talk about it and move along.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not like that. It doesn't work like that. And, I mean, I even had that mindset, too.
Mm-hmm.
It cost my son his life. I want to change that.
Well, just talking about it, I think, is helpful.
Well, I hope so, you know. I mean, some of it's selfish because I get to talk about him. It's like, I'm going to make you guys listen.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy to. Well, you know, we said before the interview, our sons are about the same age.
Right.
They're born about the same time. So, yes, I understand as a mom completely.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, I do have a younger son, and people will still ask me how he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, Aaron doesn't exist anymore. Well, yes, he does. And he always will. Just not in the physical form, but he will always be my son. So I get to talk about him, and I don't want anybody else to have to go through this. The other mothers that I've met that are in this type of situation, it's horrible. And, you know, people shouldn't have to go through this. Suicide is something that we can stop. And things have to be put in place and, you know, protections. And I think it's worth it,
mm-hmm,
you
absolutely.
Know, because their lives are worth it. So that and letting people know that do feel like that, that they are worth it and we want them here. And, I mean, I wake up every single morning wishing my son was here. And I can't have that anymore. So I just want people to know that do feel that nobody will care if they're here anymore or not. Well, people do care. And it's, you know, for the rest of my life, I have to live with this.
Well, thank you for telling Aaron's story and for sharing your story. Before we go, is there any advice you have to offer someone who's in a position like yours?
Well, if you have lost a loved one to suicide, please talk about it. People don't want to talk about it. It's getting people to go and to be willing to talk, and it is painful, and it's terrible, and it's horrible, and it hurts, and you cry, but talking about it does help. It makes a difference, and you need to tell your loved one's story. They deserve to be heard. Their story deserves to be heard.
That was WLRH producer Jenny Kennedy talking with Wendy Galloway as part of a series of discussions we're having on the issue of suicide. You can listen to their conversation again or download a podcast of tonight's show at WLRH.org. Just look under Programs for the Public Radio Hour. This is 89.3 Huntsville. I'm your host tonight, Brett Tannehill. Huntsville's local music scene is bursting at the seams with talent, and the city has commissioned an audit to find ways to better support local music resources. The latest step in that process involves encouraging the public, people like you, to take part in a survey to share information on what you'd like to hear and experience from live music in the Rocket City. You can find a direct link to the local music survey on our website at WLRH.org. I sat down with Dennis Madsen, the City of Huntsville's Manager of Urban and Long-Range Planning, to get an update on the local music audit.
I think a lot of folks have seen this coming. The idea that there is a music scene here, a really growing and unique music scene, that we're not doing everything that we could to support, or that is something that we could really grow as the city grows and take more advantage of. There's the sense that, we brand ourselves as a smart city. We don't necessarily always extend that brand to things outside of kind of the traditional sectors, like, working on the arsenal or our high-tech industry or our biotech industry. But that there really is the opportunity to link that into a lot of other fields, including music.
A consulting group called Sound Diplomacy is handling the data gathering on this. They've done similar audits across the country and around the world. How did you, or how did the City of Huntsville get connected with Sound Diplomacy and settle on them for this particular job?
I actually don't know. They came or ended up getting together with our Director of Urban Development, Shane Davis, who I always have to tip my hat to, because he is the guy who's one of the key pieces in the more traditional development programs, like bringing Toyota Mazda here and recruiting industry like that. And then one day he came and said, I think we need to think about doing a music audit. I feel like we're missing something in terms of our music industry here. And, one of the things you really underscored was, this is not about Huntsville becoming the next Nashville or becoming the next Austin. We're never going to be those cities. But we have our own vibe. We have our own kind of unique culture. And, why not really figure out what we can do to support it? And a lot of this really is about not just what the city can do, but if we have a kind of a report out there, then we know that the private sector can kind of come in and say, here are some opportunities. I didn't know if there was a market for a mid-sized club. Now I know that there's a gap in those sorts of venues, and you would have maybe a private developer come in and try to deliver something like that.
There's been a public meeting, a number of roundtable discussions, and other sort of explorations of the scene. What sort of things have you learned so far? Any surprises? Anything really stand out?
What was interesting on the plus side was, how diverse the music scene is here. I think a lot of us we find our own trails and we end up kind of seeing a lot of the same types of artists. There really is a very diverse music scene here. I think, a lot of folks don't appreciate the extent to the folk artistry that you have here. There's a really solid hip hop scene here. One of the great sort of responses from the early dig was, you do have a lot to work with here. And another advantage is that we're close to some major metros that have kind of great music reputations: Atlanta, Nashville, Memphis, Muscle Shoals. There's an opportunity, I think, for Huntsville to take advantage of its proximity to those. Not become anything like those, but find its own niche in being kind of part of a broader regional music ecosystem. On the challenge side, what we really started to discover is there's a reason folks aren't aware of the diversity in the scene. It's because a lot of them, even within the music industry, sort of fall into silos. And there aren't a lot of places where you can see these kind of cultures overlapping, where, musicians might go and just kind of hang out and bounce ideas off of each other. There's the old saw in the literary circles is that, you become a great writer by reading, and the idea being by experiencing others' kind of creative outlets, you become a more creative person, or it sort of gets your own creative juices flowing. It's important to discover opportunities where we can create places for musicians and the supportive industries, because it's never just about the musicians. It's also about the folks who help them get bookings, or the folks who show them how to do how to do recording, how to make them professional musicians, or help them launch their career. So there's a whole kind of second level of industry that occurs there. And how do we kind of help create the places where those meetings can happen?
And now we're to the point where the public has a chance to weigh mm-hmm. in and share its thoughts. Describe the public survey that's out there now. What sort of information does it seek? And the surveys also, it's worth mentioning, are customized depending on a person's connection to the scene, whether they're a fan or a business owner.
Yes, exactly. It's sort of you start following a track, if you remember those old novels of kind of, choose your adventure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's sort of like that. If you pick one spot, then it's going to make you follow a track. But the idea is first identify what is your interest in the music scene, and then based on your experience and your interest in it, what are the things that you see as challenges? Do you have kind of specific ideas or recommendations on how to address those? What are the hurdles that you seek to overcome if you are a musician or if you're just a fan? I mean, we've heard from a lot of folks, I know there's stuff out there, but I never know how to connect with it. I never know how to hear about it. I never know how to make sure that I'm aware of acts or shows before they're happening. So the big thing is just digging in. What are the hurdles there? And then what are the kind of building blocks that we can take advantage of? We talked about venues. I think the initial analysis was we're lacking certain kind of mid-sized venues, but at the same time, we have some really unique places where you can go see a show. Tangled String Studio, Low Mill, is this fantastic little hidden gem that's
right.
a great place
right.
to see, listen local. Ditto Landing has done small outdoor series. Great place to listen to some music while you're outdoors. And then, one of my personal favorites, which I think is an absolute treasure in the Southeast, and I think we could do more with if we can figure out how to make certain things work, is Three Caves.
Right.
That's a phenomenal venue, but you have to figure out, how does it make sense with the land trust to support their mission, not just sort of overuse it as a venue. How do you be sensitive to the neighborhood around it? Because it's one of the challenges in Three Caves is you have these single family neighborhood around it. You don't want to disturb them any more than they're used to. So it's looking to folks who have really experienced the industry and getting their ideas into how can we solve some of the things that are issues right now, and what are the things that are kind of special about the Huntsville region that we can take advantage of.
And everyone listening to this conversation right now, you can find a direct link to that public survey on the WLRH.org front page. You'll see a little icon on the right-hand side. You can click on that and go right to the survey. And Dennis, let's circle around to an idea that we started with in terms of why a healthy local music scene is important mm-hmm. to the city. You mentioned the quality of life issues. And one thing that I've been sort of surprised, but it makes sense, is mm-hmm. the connection to job recruitment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So maybe you could explain a little more how that connects.
Yeah, sure. When we were doing our comprehensive planning process, as we've really kind of distilled it in, through the big picture, we came up with six sort of main principles in terms of how we think that we want to grow and how we can make sure that our city's a great place to live and work. And some of them are very kind of stereotypical planning concerns. Make sure that transportation is high functioning, make sure that neighborhoods are affordable and accessible and safe. But another big principle, one of the big six, was supporting local arts and culture. And that does have kind of a twofold impact. One is improving that quality of life. When you're not at work and you're not hanging out at home, what are the things that you're doing when you're here that make you enjoy living in Huntsville? And it's also related at the same time to economic development and workforce recruitment, because you see more and more people are putting value on what it's like to live somewhere when they're choosing jobs. There's a lot of talk about the different generations, boomers versus millennials, those sorts of things. Among younger generations, they're very much known for kind of test flying cities. They'll go find a place that they like to live and worry about finding a job later.
Right.
They'll kind of dig into it. If they like the scene, if they like the vibe, if they enjoy living there, they'll stay. They'll put down roots. If they don't, they'll pick up and find someplace else that they're interested in living, and they'll go find a gig or a job there. So part of wanting to attract high quality workforce, a great creative class, a lot of technical professionals, is making sure that when they come here, it's not just about finding an affordable house in a safe neighborhood or a good job that's got a lot of mobility to it, but when you're done at the end of the day, do you have a really interesting place to go hang out and meet friends? Is there a cultural scene that's really being expressed that you can enjoy, that you can feel a part of? Because at the end of the day, that expression of music and culture really helps make us all feel like we're part of something bigger than ourselves. We feel connected to our community, and that's incredibly important for our own physical and mental well-being, and also for our sense of community, our sense of belonging to a great city.
At one of the roundtable meetings that we participated in, it seemed an idea that was floating around was the city might consider creating a specific job or office that just mm-hmm. focused on developing performing arts or local music and that sort of thing. Is that idea gaining any traction? Is it too early to talk about that? Or that seemed like an idea that had come up several times.
No, I personally like the idea. Obviously, we've got to kick it around a little bit and figure out what the responsibilities of someone like that would be. Or does it fall on a staff member who we've already got? But I like the idea. I mean, recognizing that these sorts of things are about making sure that people enjoy living here, and they are very much about economic development. They are about how you recruit industry and new workers. I think it warrants having someone who is spending time, engaging the arts community and engaging the music community, and figure out how we continue to be really a kind of an interesting and fun city to live in.
In a best case scenario, what happens with the data that you gather during this local music audit? Let's kind of work in dream world here for a minute. What's the best case scenario?
Sure. Well, I think some of it, we may end up developing a kind of clear strategy for the city in terms of not only developing our music scene and maybe identifying ways that we can support artists, but also that we have kind of a recruitment sheet that says, hey, private industry, we've got this great music scene here that you can come and be a part of and that you can support and that you can make money, being a musician in Huntsville, that maybe the city has a part in a venue. I mean, obviously, that's still something that we're discussing a lot. Does the city do an amphitheater or something like that? Or even better, do you have someone come in like at the Mid-City Development or at Ditto Landing or someplace else, and do you end up having some sort of music venue there? So, there are really a lot of paths out of this that we see being positives. One is growing the artist community. Another is growing the supportive industry. And then another is growing the different venues and places that you can have shows or experience music in Huntsville.
Comments on the public survey are being accepted through September 10th. Hmm. What happens after that? Is there some sort of timetable for moving forward?
Yeah, we're going to probably kind of digest that, kind of analyze what comes through there. Then there's another round of meetings that we'll have probably in the fall. We're anticipating sometime early in 2019 having a strategic report. It's one thing to get a
public presentation of some kind.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I think it's one thing to get to kind of get some recommendations or an analysis, but you really want some marching orders. We're going to rely on sound diplomacy to say, all right, you've got this vision of being this great musical community. Here are some steps you can actually take to get there. And that's really what we're looking at in early 2019 to kind of come up with that plan. I do have to offer the one little caveat. If you go and try and take the survey, depending on the lengths, if it's a capital H in Huntsville, the link might not work. I've learned that some places it came out as capital H Huntsville and people end up with a dead link. If it's lowercase H Huntsville in the survey link, you should find your way through. So sometimes, depending on who's posted it or reposted it or re-reposted it, you may have to edit the link to find it. But I think most folks will be able to get there. And we really, really want to push folks to take this. I mean, the more input,
I mean, the data
the
is only as good as the number of people who
respond
to it.
Absolutely. We think that, there are a lot of people in a lot of different sectors of the industry who can weigh in. And, one of the big things about this is the city recognizing we don't know as much about the music industry as the people who work in it every day do. We want very badly to understand what it is they're dealing with and what sort of things that they see that would be of value to them. We can't create anything on our own. Even in planning, I'm not going to know your neighborhood as well as you do. So it's important for me to engage you when I'm doing planning for your neighborhood. Same thing in the music industry. It's really important for us to engage the retailers and the artists and the venue operators so that we have the clearest picture we possibly can get for shaping the strategy for improving the music industry in the future.
Okay, now one final question for Dennis Madsen, citizen of Huntsville.
Oh, okay.
do you have any particular things about the local music scene that you enjoy? Do you have a favorite band? Do you have a favorite place you'd like to go? A favorite kind of music you'd like to listen to? What is your specific connection to it?
I really go a lot of times just for the experience of hearing the music. I don't always follow bands. I was the same way when I was in Atlanta. And Atlanta had a great music scene with a lot of varied venues and artists. A lot of times I would go just because I liked the club where someone was playing. And a lot of times it was a great way to kind of find a new artist. And there are so many good ones out there. Sometimes just landing, you know, trying a new place to see a show, you come across an artist that you might not have run across in the past. So I really just like hanging out places. You know, I think the Yellowhammer and the Straight to Yale campus, it's a fantastic place just to catch a little one or two person act. I've stumbled upon a number of folks there that I never would have heard in the past. And then Three Caves as well has got to be one of my favorites. Of course, I don't like the hot weather all the time, and I love the fact that it is always a nice kind of high 60s in that little bowl at Three Caves. That, to me, is the perfect place to watch a show, and frequently it could be anybody up there on the stage. I'm just enjoying, you know, being in that concert bowl.
That was Dennis Madsen, Manager of Urban and Long-Range Planning with the City of Huntsville, discussing the newly released Local Music Survey that's part of the city's audit of its local music resources. The audit is only as good as the data it gathers, so make sure you let your voice be heard during the public survey. You can find a direct link to that survey on our website at WLRH.org. This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville. In tonight's final segment, WLRH Community Newsroom producer Kathy Jones has been talking with folks about how the state and region's water resources are being managed. This time, Kathy took our public microphone to Chattanooga and met with two people working with the Tennessee Valley Authority. Amanda Turk is TVA's Water Supply Civil Engineer, and Gary Springston is TVA's Water Supply Program Manager. They discussed how TVA keeps watch over the Tennessee River.
The Tennessee River is the most utilized water source per square mile in the United States. It's the fifth largest river system, and on average 10 billion, with a B, gallons per day are taken out of the river system and used offstream, recycled, and then about 95% of that is returned and put back into the river for downstream use. The tributaries in the Tennessee River is an abundant, reliable water resource for about 5.1 million people, and we're expecting that number to increase to 6.2 million people by 2040. So we need to make sure that we continue to have that be a reliable source out into the future. The Tennessee River watershed covers seven states. So it starts up in the Virginia, North Carolina, and it travels down into Tennessee, parts of Georgia, Alabama, and then it goes back north through West Tennessee and discharges into the Ohio River in Kentucky, the state of Kentucky. And it's about 49,000 square miles. And the TVA has 49 dams in the Tennessee River system, and we integrate those 49 dams to be able to use for navigation, flood risk, electric generation, water supply, water quality, and recreation. And we try to balance those uses, and we have an operating policy that was developed in 2004 to ensure that we can try to meet all of those demands of the river system.
How does the TVA manage the water flows across the Tennessee River Basin?
We look at inflows, so the rainfall that would be coming down, and we have different demands downstream of each individual reservoir. So some reservoirs may have a minimum flow based off of a water quality constraint. Some of them may have water temperature restraints that require a flow. So we have all of these different trigger points based on the time of year, and it's a 24/7, 365 operation based out of Knoxville. They're constantly monitoring this, and they will release either by generation or by spilling or we have some sluice gates where they can pull the water through the dam without spilling or without generating. And that's how we'll move the water through the system and monitor the flows through the Tennessee River system.
How does the TVA control who can pull water from the Tennessee River?
That's through our 26A jurisdiction. So if a industry or a municipality wants to put an intake into the Tennessee or any of its tributaries, it is considered an obstruction. So the structure itself is an obstruction, and we can permit that through the 26A, which is part of the TVA Act. And you have to apply, it's a NEPA, a National Environmental Policy Act, and it's basically an environmental review saying that that structure and that withdrawal will not impact environment or navigation or any of those other uses that we use in the river. We do a joint review with the Corps of Engineers. We'll go through and review that withdrawal and assign a length of, if it's approved, it'll be set, it'll have a maximum volume amount set to it and a span of so many years that that permit is valid. So it could be a 5-year permit, a 10, a 15, or a 20-year permit, depending on where it would be located in the system.
And if a water user has a changing requirement, would they need to come back to TVA to get reauthorized?
Yes. If the intake volume changes above their permitted intake amount, they would need to come back. If they are relocating or if they are remodifying their structure in any way, they would need to come back to TVA. We actually grandfathered in any pre-existing intakes prior to 2005. So if there were any intakes existing prior to 2005 that are deciding to go make modifications to their structures, we are asking all of those to come back and get permits now. And that's been one that we've been really trying to keep an eye out for. A lot, you know, of those pre-existing intakes are now reaching their life cycle to get upgraded. And we're seeing a lot more applications coming in of life cycle upgrades.
You recently completed a Tennessee River Water Basin survey. What did it include, and how did you conduct the survey?
Our Tennessee Water Use Report is a 5-year water use study, and we work with the 7 Valley states. We gather data for thermoelectric, industrial, public supply, and agriculture irrigation. And we look at how that water is used. So we look at how much is withdrawn and whether it is surface water or groundwater, and then how much of that is returned back into the system. And we get the data from the states directly, and we go through the database. It's got about, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 different points. It's a very large database. We look at it by our reservoir, so it's a GIS-based database. So we look at all of the different intakes in a specific reservoir and all of the different discharges within a specific reservoir, and look at how the consumptive use, so how much is withdrawn and returned within that reservoir. This data was based on the 2015 withdrawal and return, and then we did a 2040 estimate. So we used the Woods and Pool population growth estimates and then their mining and earnings estimates and some other economic growth factors, and did a projection out to 2040 to what we thought we could potentially see as a water use potential in 2040, to make sure that our current operations and our current, the way that we're currently operating the TVA system, would still be able to meet the needs of the people in the valley out to 2040.
So are you seeing any areas where you've got to make adjustments or need to grow?
So we have 15 years of record. We look at all those projections out to 2030, out to 2040, and we're actually seeing that water use will be going down. And some of that we're seeing is actually attributed to people are becoming more and more aware of the need for conservation. In the early 2000s, there just wasn't a very big public concern, and we weren't seeing that in the projections at that time. We weren't assuming people would ever become conscious of the need for conservation. And now that we're starting to actually see that, even this year was the first year we actually saw a drop in public use since we started doing this report. Public use was down, and it was actually close to the 2005 levels. We're doing our projections, and our projections are up, but they're not up much from what we're expecting. So the per capita use is going to continue to drop, even though the population will continue to grow.
And so you repeat this every 5 years so that if you see a similar trend, you'll know it's real or that it's long-term trend, not just a short-term trend.
That's correct. That's why we do this every 5 years. The economy changes quite a bit in 5 years. You have a year like 2008, and it can change your projection years pretty rapidly. You have things like a presidential change that changes how you determine what's going to happen at our plants. That's going to determine what happens from the environmental side of things. So what we decide to do at our fossil and nuclear plants, really, they're our largest water users as far as withdrawal. We do return about 99% of the water that we withdraw from those plants, but they are the largest water withdrawals in the valley. But as that generation mix changes, we have to keep an eye on that about every 5 years, and political input and just even a lot of the economic drivers, you know, changing to LEDs has really changed how our load has changed TVA-wide. So we're constantly changing our business goals as a company, and we're having to look at how that's impacting our water usage as well.
So conservation of electricity, like solar panels, LEDs, is making a difference in the demands on the power plants?
It is, and it's making a difference on the demand for the water as well.
How would TVA ensure that the downstream users continue to get the water that they need?
So TVA's policy, it's similar to what I mentioned earlier. We have that 26A NEPA policy. It just has an extra couple of steps. If we were to have a request for an interbasin transfer, we would require before we would start a NEPA review that the state of origin would need to send TVA a letter of no objection stating that they do not object to us permitting or looking at a potential permit of an interbasin transfer to another state, whether it be Georgia or another state that might be requesting an interbasin transfer. Then we give the other six states 30 days to comment, and that decides what level of NEPA review. So there's three different levels of NEPA review. There's a lower level that's called a CEC, a categorical exclusion checklist. So it's just it's just a simpler level of review. And then there's the EIS, environmental impact statement level, and then there's an EA, an environmental assessment. So we'll use the comments from the state and then our internal expertise to kind of help determine which level of environmental review we would do. And then we would start the environmental review before we would begin. It would be a board level decision, but we would not even begin any of that process at all unless the states came to an agreement. But the states would have to come to an agreement first.
Would those states just be where the water came from and where it's going to, or would it include all the other states as well on the agreement?
The states would just be where it's coming from and where it's going to, but the other states would have 30 days to be able to provide us comments to determine the level of the review that we would do.
How would TVA work with the states as they're developing their water plans?
We have a reservoir operating policy that's a public document. You can find it on our website. And we also work with the states directly, and we provide presentations with them to let them know how we operate both during times of flood, during normal operations, and during times of drought to be able to meet our six different goals, so that we can ensure that our target and our requirements don't hinder anything that they may have in their state plans. So we work closely with the states during their state water plans, because the state residents are our stakeholders as well. And we want to ensure that anything that goes into the state water plan meets the needs of those residents and our stakeholders.
What's the latest on the dispute between Tennessee and Georgia over the state boundary to allow Georgia to gain access to the Tennessee River?
I've not heard anything other than what's been in the media. TVA does have a policy in place if Atlanta or Georgia were to ever come to TVA, but other than that, it's a state issue.
Bruce Springsteen, and TVA's Water Supply Program Manager. When we look at the permitting process for any water intake, whether it's agriculture, municipality, or industry, like Amanda said, we have a specific process, the NEPA process. And we are charged by Congress that we have to do an environmental review. There's no way around it. And as Amanda said, there's three levels of environmental review. CEC at the very lowest, the environmental impact statement at the very highest. And if a big city like Atlanta, Birmingham, anybody decides to pull water out of the system, that's no different than Huntsville or the town of Madison or Decatur or anyone else wanting to pull water out of the system. We still have to go through the same review, same process, same decisions. Nothing gets done until the environmental review is done. Granted, if it's outside the watershed, it's an air basin transfer, we have a couple extra steps in there before and after the environmental review. But it's basically the same process we do for everyone else. So it'll be a little bit longer process because of the impacts that could be associated with an air basin transfer. And why there's concern over air basin transfers, because all the water that's taken out of the Tennessee River system won't come back. So we have a total 100% loss of water there. So that's why there's a lot of concern over the system. The way we operate the river system is we are able to meet our six beneficial needs by the way we operate the system. And when we implemented this operating plan, it took into account no new additional interbasin transfers. So if we have an additional large-scale interbasin transfer that's proposed being taken out of the Tennessee River system, we could in fact have some pretty significant impacts to our ability to meet the six beneficial uses. And that's what we would have to evaluate in the environmental review.
That was WLRH Community Newsroom producer Kathy Jones talking with Amanda Turk and Gary Springsteen from the Tennessee Valley Authority about management practices for the Tennessee River. If you'd like to hear any of tonight's segments again, just check out the podcast of tonight's show at WLRH.org. Look under programs for the Public Radio Hour. I'm Brett Tannehill. Have a great night, and remember, every day, do something good.